I'm SP from Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D., a show about the general Marvel comic universe, part of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're checking out now. Shows on the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other hilarious and fun geeky shows at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
This is the official GunnaGeek.com show. Here we run down the latest news and happenings in the world of geek. These are your hosts for the show, Steven, Chris, and SP.
Hello and welcome to an all-new episode of the official Gunna Geek Show. This is episode 409. I'm Steven, and I'm pleased to say Chris Farrell is here this week.
This is my second appearance to open the show.
Also, we've got the wonderful Pioneer, Stargate.
Hello, everyone. It is February 2024. We're having a blast at the Gunna Geek Show. We got a lot of great stories for you. If you're watching on YouTube, by the way, there's a whole list of stuff over there on the sidebar of what we're going to talk about.
There is. And if you didn't know this, we stream this on some day during the month, once a month. That's how it works here on the official Gunna Geek Show. We choose a day at some point. We record on that day, and then at some point we choose a day for the following month. So this is the February edition of the official Gunna Geek Show. Thanks to everybody who is watching us live at GunnaGeek.com/live. As well, if you are listening or watching this afterwards, thank you very much for that. Let us know if you are watching this afterwards. Comment wherever. Let us know. And also let us know what drew you here. I mean, by that, it was a Chris or SP, because I know you're listening to this show or watching the show because you were paying attention to them on one of their other shows, and then you thought you'd just come over and find me here. You saw me here. You're kind of regretting your decision right now. I know that's the case.
All I can tell you is that thank goodness this is leap year, because if we recorded this podcast tomorrow, it might not be February any longer.
But today's the 26th.
You're like ruining it, Steven. You should have just leaned into it.
Yes, you are correct. Is that helpful?
Steven, I came here from StephenCam.com. You should know that you need to adjust the lighting in your living room. It's not quite right.
Still don't think that's a thing.
That's what you think.
I'm not checking it out. All right.
Yeah, don't. I have no idea what it actually is.
Let's get into the news. Should we do that?
Please.
We're going to kick the news off this week with a person who is named Chris, and he likes to talk about things called Nintendo, and sometimes he likes to talk about rumors as well, and sometimes you put all three of those things together and you have Chris Farrell talking about Switch rumors.
Yeah, real quick before I do that, I just checked StephenCam.com is available if we want to pay $2,300. I don't care enough for a joke.
I mean, is it Canadian dollars? Because that might be doable.
Oh, I mean, that's like a Snickers bar and a soda. Yeah, we could do that.
I think we're good.
I don't know. It redirects me to hugedomains.com, which I'm not really sure I believe is real, and I don't have the time to go and dig into this anymore. But if we have a benefactor out there that wants to buy StephenCam.com for us, you can hit me up on the threads at the Chris Farrell and we can work something out.
I'm just going to put it out there. It sounds legitimate. Steven Cam would have something to do with a domain that has huge in it. Absolutely.
Well, yeah, huge power bill from all the tech you have.
Absolutely.
Of course. So let's talk about the Switch 2. We've long been theorizing, rather, hey, there's got to be a new Switch coming soon. When are we going to hear something? And the Switch is what, 7-8 years old at this point? So it's time to start wondering what may be going on. And we actually have a little bit of news that's leaked out. And it looks like right now, according to a report from the Nikkei that was then translated by Video Game Chronicles, Nintendo is targeting a March 2025 release for the successor to the Switch. Nikkei corroborated earlier reporting by the specialist press stating the console's release had slipped out of its original late 2024 window. So if you remember correctly, original rumors were we were looking at holiday 2024. Now it's starting to look like a March 2025 release date. Nikkei had a few extra details saying first that this is a firm March window as opposed to an early 2025 statement. Nintendo hopes to release the Switch 2 in the next financial year, and part of the reason they delayed the launch of the Switch 2 is not just ensuring a strong software lineup, but their intent is to try and build up enough inventory of the console to avoid similar issues we saw with the PlayStation 5 and Xbox shortages when those devices came out in the depths of the coronavirus pandemic, which also made it harder to get said devices. And also, Nintendo's hope is by having enough stock on hand, they'll be able to avoid the scalping problem, which was kind of a black eye for both Microsoft and Sony there for a while, because people couldn't buy their consoles, but the scalpers all had like four or five each that they were selling for exorbitant fees.
The Switch was like that at launch though too, so it can't be forgotten that people had troubles getting their hands on that when it first came out.
I assume it'll be the case here unless Nintendo just really builds up the reserves. Most ominously, Nikkei has said that the Switch 2 release date could potentially slip beyond March if the software isn't ready, or more importantly, if Nintendo hasn't hit that internal metric for what they deem to be enough physical hardware units that have been manufactured. So it seems like they're really wanting to steer clear of any of these supply shortages that we saw in this previous generation of consoles. The Nikkei also corroborated some earlier reports the Switch 2 will be a hybrid portable console, very similar to what we have with the Switch right now, but it will feature a larger screen than the current model. Recent reporting by Video Game Chronicles cites multiple sources after dev kits arrived at partner studios that said the console would, quote, be able to be used in portable mode, similar to the Nintendo Switch. So both Video Game Chronicles and Nikkei have corroborated these facts. Finally, we have a 2024 report from a Japanese analyst that suggests, this is not confirmed, but suggests the console will have an 8-inch screen compared to the original 6.2 inches on the OG Switch and 7 inches on the Switch OLED. Now, the thing that really stands out to me on all of this, though, no official word or no solid word on whether there will be backwards compatibility with this generation of Switch games, be it via physical media, i.e. the cartridges you pop in there, or if the digital ones could potentially be. And for Nintendo, it's kind of a mixed track record. Sometimes they're backwards compatible, sometimes they're not. Remember when we had this jump to the Switch, everyone that bought a bunch of digital games on the Wii and the Wii U shop, none of those carried over to the Switch. So everyone had to rebuy those same classic games again if they wanted them, for example. So I guess the bottom line here is the Switch 2 sounds like what we thought it would be, which is an enhanced version of what we see now with the Switch 1 with a bigger screen. I guess one other thing that we haven't had confirmed, but I assume will be the case, is whether the Joy-Cons can pop off and on.
Mm.
I assume that'll be the case. We've even seen that move over into the Switch competitors. The Lenovo version of the Steam Deck, which I'm forgetting the name of all of a sudden, has like an 8.8-inch screen and has pop-off controllers very similar to Joy-Cons.
Maybe they could make the Joy-Cons not suck this time around because they are so problematic. Whether it's the disconnecting function that seems to happen on a lot, the whatever you call the thumb pieces, they always lose their traction. Like, they've been so problematic from the beginning. They even early on extended the warranty as an exception for the Joy-Cons because of these problems.
So the stick drift problem is an issue, and more so on the Switch Lites, because it's not like you can just replace the Joy-Con or tell Nintendo, send me a new Joy-Con. I guess the thing we could see is, I believe it's the Hall effect sensors is what they're called, or something like that, that they've started putting in there that are immune to stick drift, that some of these premium third-party controllers and stuff tend to have, is Nintendo could use those thumbsticks to kind of eliminate stick drift, because it basically uses magnets to do everything versus contacts on flimsy circuit boards with plastic all around it.
So, Chris, I got a question for you. You mentioned the screen size at the end. Is that with or without the rounded bevels?
Good question. We honestly don't know. My guess is it's the typical measurement we get for things like this, which is the diagonal screen size.
Okay. Well, the other question that I had for you is, will there or will there not be a notch?
I mean, I assume not, because they haven't done a notch in any of the current Switch screens.
Okay. Will there be a 3.5-millimeter headphones jack?
So I would assume yes, because Nintendo made a point of putting that in the Switch 1, and it was very late in Switch 1's firmware when official Bluetooth headphone support came out for it, because for a long time there, people were buying USB-C dongles to plug into their Switch when they were playing it undocked to then get Bluetooth audio. And I want to say it was either 2 or 3 years ago that Nintendo updated the firmware so you can pair Bluetooth headphones, but you're still going to have the same problem with other gaming systems where when you pair Bluetooth, there's latency issues, especially if you're playing things where sound is a very important part of the game, is that if your sound is delayed by a second and a half or something like that, it's going to be very noticeable when playing a game. So my guess would be they continue to include the 3.5 millimeter headphone jack.
Is there a possibility that you could hold it wrong?
I mean, you could hold it backwards and you can't see the screen. So it is entirely possible you could hold it wrong or all upside down. And then you're like, why is my left stick not working? Well, because you're actually using the right stick.
Okay. All right. Just covering all the bases. Oh, one last thing. Does the battery catch fire?
Oh, I was just going to say it.
I would assume not, but that's something they'll have to figure out during all their regulatory testing.
All right. A year from now, you going to put your pre-order in?
I honestly don't know. I guess it kind of shakes out what are the games that are targeted for the Switch 2 or whatever they end up calling it launch. If there's no games I care about, what's the point? Because it's just going to sit on a shelf, or I have tons of games in my backlog that I need to play right now. So why bother? In all likelihood, it's going to be something that if it's interesting, I'll pick it up at some point, but I don't know that I need to be an early adopter. Now, Steven marked this time code because inevitably I'll probably change my mind because of FOMO and I'll end up buying one is my guess. But as of right now, my current plan is more just to see what's going to happen and that decision be based off of what the launch titles are. If there's a must-have launch title, it would be a lot more compelling to me. If there's not, then I don't see any reason not to hold off because I've got multiple Switch games in my back catalog I need to play still.
I feel like I missed out because I had not purchased a Switch for myself. I can't say I didn't purchase a Switch because during the pandemic, I did end up buying one for my nephew for a birthday gift, which was jacked up in price immensely. And I've never bought one for myself. So I've never actually played one. I've not used one. And I feel like I've missed out. So Chris, have I missed out? And what is that going to do to me long-term psychologically?
I mean, I guess it depends on how much do you like Mario and Zelda games and stuff like that. There's a ton of really good ones on the Switch. Do you like a lot of the Nintendo first party games? If so, then arguably you might be missing out on some fun experiences. I mean, yeah, the good news is the Switch prices are going to drop as we get close to the Switch 2 release.
That's true.
Especially people that want to buy a Switch 2 and decide they're going to sell their Switch. And if it is backwards compatible, people aren't going to be hanging on to their Switch 1 as much because they won't need it if it's backwards compatible.
I'm going to say that if it does not have backwards compatibility, the Switch 2 will fall more in the Wii U camp than not. And why I say that is because people went to the Switch because it was different enough from the predecessor. A Switch 2, by all the rumors, is not that much different. And I think that it will be hard for people to give up their library if it's not calling them for other features. Now, yes, the nice to haves are going to be there for people, but I just think that backwards compatibility will be a make or break for this.
I think this is a current, this is something that we do every console generation. We've had this debate before on the show is, and I'm guilty of it. I think we overestimate the value of backwards compatibility to most consumers. I think as I re-educate or re-look and recenter myself based off of experience here, I think backwards compatibility is really important for like the first year or two of a console. Well, it would have been in the PS5 and the Xbox version of things because first party games were also delayed as part of the pandemic issues. So your real reason to buy a PS5 or an Xbox Series S or X was, okay, I can play this game that came out on the Xbox One, but they've put out a patch that gives it 4K graphics and things like this. I don't know if it matters as much for the Switch going forward. That being said, if the Switch is what I think it is, which is updated hardware based off of the same chipset from NVIDIA, just a more advanced chip with a bigger screen and slightly different controllers, I don't see any reason why, if it's relatively affordable on Nintendo's part, you don't make it backwards compatible because it then becomes a selling point. Unless Nintendo's really committed to selling both the Switch 1 and Switch 2 at the same time. But my guess is what we'll see when the Switch 2 comes out is, well, This is the last major release coming out on the Switch. If you want Metroid Prime 4, which I've been promised for 6 years now and still haven't gotten, even though I've had a pre-order in for probably 8 years, you're going to have to buy a Switch too.
Well, I look forward to finding out what you think of this when you buy it in a year's time.
I mean, a year's time would be right before. That'd be impossible. I would have to get it from scalpers then. Because it's March, it's supposed to be coming out, and it's February right now, Stephen.
Yes, I know. But by the time I release this, it'll be April. So, anyways.
Okay, fair enough. We're covered then. What was I thinking?
All right, well, moving on to the next news point here. Let's talk about security camera breaches. Yes, we're back with more talk about that because...
StephenCam.com.
This past week, I got, I guess it was just over a week now, I got an email from Wyze, the camera company. I have a couple of Wyze cameras. We'll get to that in a minute. But there was an email that I got that said, quote, "On Friday morning, we had a service outage that led to a security incident. Your account and over 99.75% of all Wyze accounts were not affected by the security event, but we wanted to make sure you are aware of the incident and let you know what we are doing to make sure it doesn't happen again." And the summary that they go on to explain is that there was an outage with Amazon Web Services. And so what ended up happening was when everything ended up coming back online for this particular, I don't know, whatever it was that they had, it ended up showing some users other timelines and thumbnails for other people's cameras. And in some cases, they were able to actually get in and view those. They said that this was something that about 13,000 users received thumbnails from cameras that were not their own, and 1,504 users tapped on them. Now, they said they've put protocols in to stop this from the future. I think what's interesting is the company Unify had a very similar situation back in December. It was same sort of thing where other people saw certain cameras, were able to click into them. So I don't know if it's related to the same thing or just happens to be two independent issues had the same symptoms. But yeah, that's something that's a little bit alarming. And it's not the first time that we've seen this with a cloud-based camera. It probably won't be the last. For me personally, most of my cameras are locally based. I do have 4 Wyze cameras. 3 are in my travel trailer, so that was no concern there. One of which is in my living room, but is powered by a smart switch that I only use when the house is empty. And I actually manually turn it on, manually turn it off. And that's just partially to pay attention to see if my dog's being annoying and tell her to stop it. Part is just for security. And as soon as I get home, I actually turn the camera around. I've got it. It's a pan and tilt. I bought it for that reason. Face it to the wall and shut off the power. Now, whether or not I'm going to keep this in the future, I might be a little more tempted to get that living room camera fished into my other system. And also, it's a good opportunity for me to look at my local setup and just double check security and some things like that, make sure I haven't left it connected by chance. So if you have this, be aware. And unfortunately, it seems like the only systems that are out there where you know they're secure, that are cloud-based, are coming with their own downsides. And what I mean by that is a while back, because of a privacy issue Ring had, they enabled the ability to put end-to-end encryption on there. But unfortunately, that takes away a bunch of the extra features like the ALEXA greetings and some other things as well. So, you know, I guess it's just part of the risk that we face by having cloud-connected cameras. And we hope this doesn't happen, but I guess it will continue to happen.
It makes me really glad that the cameras I have in my house are all out facing outside for the most part. I have one camera left that was in my living room to check on my dog when I was gone for the day. And I think it's powered off right now, because I never leave the house, so I don't really need it. And all of my other ones are facing outside so that I have sight of all of the entrances to my house, or being able to see if anyone is misbehaving, for lack of a better term. So I, for my purposes, Wyze cameras, I don't really give a crap if someone could see my driveway for a little bit, because that's not going to tell them much. And that's not really something I worry about people seeing because my neighbors see it all day, every day when they drive around. Same with my backyard, honestly. But if I had a camera in my house that may have been accessible, I would have concerns there. And the fact that it keeps happening with some of these, I don't mean this derogatorily, but I'm going to say it this way, cheaper security camera folks, where they make up, they'll sell you a cheaper camera to make up the subscription on the back end to make up the costs for it. That's a bit concerning. And I would have concerns if I was using my Wyze cameras for internal security at this point, because this is what, the second time in the past couple years that's happened with them. Plus they had a bug with Gen 2 or Gen 1 cameras that they just never patched. They just made them no longer work.
Oh, well, this is from Wyze, the company that admits that they would have gone under if they didn't have so many people pick up on the Protect Plus or whatever it's called, or that they, the subscription.
And if you go to Walmart, they're rebranded as Roku cameras and stuff like that too.
Oh.
So if you start seeing Roku smart home products, they're just rebadged Wyze stuff that Walmart sells.
How do you feel about this, SB? Because I know you don't have Wyze cameras, but I do know that I have tapped in and watched you do some interesting dances in your garage on your Ring cameras. Those are some fun 11 o'clock viewing.
When my daughter's dog Cooper was living here, my daughter bought a Yi camera, a Yi camera.
Oh yeah.
And it was focused on the front bay window where there was a dog bed there. And it was literally just to look at him. And previous to that, it was looking at his kennel when he was in the kennel. I weaned him off the kennel about a year and a half, 2 years when he was about that age. And then he continued to live with us for almost 3 years. He left about a month ago to go live with his mom. And I was really happy for that camera to leave the house because I was not confident in it whatsoever, but it did allow us to view him, and we had it in areas that were not going to be compromising whatsoever. They were literally just looking at the areas that the dog was going to be at. So I'm fine with that. If you isolate the view that these cameras can get, they could be used for an Internet of Things attack. So you have to watch out for that. But as far as Wyze and Unify cameras, I think eventually it's going to hit them all because they all have some sort of security breach that is going to be found at some point. You can't assume any data source is ironclad anymore. You have to assume that the company that you are dealing with, that you are doing business with, eventually will give your information away. Not purposefully, but it's just going to happen. So you try to protect yourself as much as you can. Steven, the way that you do that for the most part is you have a lot of actual cameras on your own system internally, most of which I believe are hardwired. So they're not necessarily going Wi-Fi. I know you have some, but if you have all these devices that are behind a firewall, you know, at least there's that, but then you connect them to some sort of cloud service and you just have to assume that somebody's going to be able to take that at some point in time. I mean, take a look at the cell phone breaches that occurred, right? And that those are supposed to be ironclad and we found out that they weren't. So it's just going to happen over and over again.
Yeah, I agree. I think it is something you kind of need to expect. And what I think is interesting is the way sometimes people think about these privacy concerns differently. I know of somebody, and I'll stick it vague who it is. It's an acquaintance of mine. Or is it a friend? Or is it a coworker? Or is it a family member? Who knows? But they refuse to put a voice assistant in their house. They absolutely mm-hmm. refuse to. They have indoor Wyze cameras. And I'm just like, going all the time. I'm like, did you see the email that came out? So I don't know. I just find it kind of funny how sometimes people see things differently.
I was in a different room. So we weren't scheduled to talk about this tonight, but I just reinstalled a new smart switch to replace one that went bad. We could talk more in details about it later. Anyway, I was like in an area of the house that did not have a smart speaker by it. And I very quietly said, you know, a word, turn on that light. And then I heard like two rooms over, ba-bling, you know, the notification that it was turning on. I'm like, yep, those mics are picking up absolutely everything we say in this house.
Yep.
Well, let us know if you've had any security breaches like this, whether it was cameras or a voice assistant like SP was just saying. Let us know. What is your thoughts on all this? You can come to our Discord at gunnageek.com/discord. And while you're there, you should head on over to the outer-space-talk-and-something-else, because it cuts off, channel, where you can talk about space news like the stuff SP's just about to tell you about.
Since we last talked, there has not been a new Starship launch. But I'm going to tell you everything that happened between now and then, and the fact that by the next time we podcast, there might have been a launch of Starship. So Starship, the IFT-3 or Integrated Flight Test 3, will take place with Ship 23 and Booster 10. Last week, as we record this on Wednesday, February 14th, actually 2 weeks ago, Wednesday, February 14th and Friday, February 16th, it attempted two wet dress rehearsals, which is basically you do everything you would normally do in a launch. You get down to the zero, and then you just shut everything down. So no launch actually occurs. Unfortunately, they failed, both of them. And the likely culprit for all this was the extensive orbital launch mount upgrades that could not provide enough pressure to help load the propellant. Fixes are underway currently, including the addition of more vaporizers. They took the stack off the orbital launch mount, and they went to work right away to add more vaporizers, which they had on hand. They just hadn't had time to put them in place before the wet dresser rehearsal. So there's going to be enough pressure when they get to the actual next attempt at wet dress rehearsal. So some of the rocket changes since IFT-2, if you remember, Booster 9 failed during the boost back phase after the ship 25 had separated from it. And that was largely due, assessed anyway, to fuel sloshing around in the tanks. And that sloshing fuel damaged fueling pipes and the system that actually used to, you know, move the fuel to the rockets. There have been potentially new baffles inside the tanks of the Booster 10, and that will limit the fuel movement. It's very much like the gas tank in your car, that they just put baffles in there to prevent the sloshing of the fuel. Also, the Ship 25 explosion, as we talked about last time, was largely due to intentional liquid oxygen vent because they used it as the actual payload. They used the weight of the fuel for the payload. Now, I don't know how they're going to fix it. Have they used cargo instead of fuel for ballast? Have they fixed the system to vet the oxygen in a different manner so it won't cause everything to blow up? A full explanation still has to be given on what happened, and we haven't received it yet, but we will see what the corrective actions are probably before launch. Elon Musk last week said in an X space, which is a conversational thing that they have over on X. I don't know. I don't go over there for them. Anyway, last week he said that the target right now for IFT-3 is the second week in March. Now, I have to remind everything that there is such a thing as Elon Musk time, which is basically take any time estimate that he has and multiply it by 2 to 4 times. So it could be up to 12 weeks from last week, according to Musk time, which would put it around the May 15th time frame. So anywhere between the middle of March in the middle of May, we're looking at the launch for the next one. The IFT-2 mishap investigation is still not completed, and it's not released to the public, at least. But today, Ship 28 conducted another spin prime test on the ship testing stand that's out at the launch site. SpaceX last week had applied for a waiver to launch up to 9 times a year from Boca Chica, so they are planning on starting to launch many, many times from Boca Chica. Yep, take a drink, y'all. I said it twice. I'll say it again. Boca Chica, Boca Chica, Boca Chica. This is up from 5, which is what they were approved for. And I think it's really telling where they think they want to be by the end of the year to apply for this now, knowing that later on in the year, they might want to rapidly start launching. And they need to. They need to for the Artemis program, and they need to launch their next series of Starlink satellites. So it's not a, hey, we'll get to it when we get to it. It needs to happen sooner rather than later. So they're thinking that it could happen this year. By the way,
and that
to
follows,
enable
that follows, by the way, the history of SpaceX. We saw that for a couple of years there, where it was a huge amount of subsequent launches. So that tracks.
Last year, the United States had 116 launches. 96 of those were Falcon 9 or Falcon Heavy.
Wow.
Out of 116, they launched more than several other top countries combined. And then there were several others as well, like 20 other launches, including two from Starship. So they really had 98 launches last year, SpaceX did, and almost got to 100. They do plan on doing 150 this year between the Falcon 9, Falcon Heavy, and Starship. So I'm really looking at this from a access to space issue, going, they have done the impossible. They have done what the shuttle has not been able to do. They have done what whole countries can't do. And that's pretty impressive. Preparations, by the way, to enable Starship to launch more often are underway at Boca Chica. They have applied to construct that second tower that we thought they were going to start constructing a few years ago. What they did is they took the tower sections that had been placed at Kennedy Space Center. They have transported them to Boca Chica via barge. And now they're just sitting waiting for this permit application, which also there is a public notice out there to say whether or not they're going to be able to impart into the wetlands just a little bit more down there, which they just need to do. But I mean, if the United States wants to maintain its lead in its access to space, which I think it does as a nation, I think they're going to eventually allow this. And in order for Starship to work, in order for Artemis to work, they're going to need to be launching from multiple places in the planet. So Texas and Florida are two places. They probably eventually will be launching from California as well. I don't know where else they want to launch. They did sell off the two oil rigs, or at least I knew they were for sale. I didn't know that they actually sold them off. But it's the preparations are underway to be able to launch from two towers at Boca Chica.
Anything getting closer to me? Because I would really, really, really like to have you guys finally crash some of that space debris into me.
If they do launch from California, they can go straight north and go right over your house.
Awesome, because that is definitely what needs to happen. While we're recording this show, preferably.
That's how we go viral.
We've been looking forward to it. Elon Musk said in a tweet response back in December that the next stage of the Starship program should be called the Two Towers, you know, in a reference to Lord of the Rings there. This is just one of two mega rockets that are under development right now. The other one has been quietly being developed, and we're talking about Blue Origin's New Glenn. The first stage had its first full vertical stand on February 13th. Company didn't say anything about it. It was just the photographers that were there that were able to see it and capture it that we knew that this happened. Now, their Pathfinder vehicle, which according to them includes a lot of flight hardware, or maybe I can't remember this statement, entire flight hardware, went vertical a week later on the 21st of February. The New Glenn rocket will have twice the lifting capacity of a Falcon 9, having about 45 tons capable to lift to LEO or low Earth orbit. It only has half a Starship, though, which is projected to have 150 tons to LEO. For reference, Falcon Heavy can lift about 50 tons to LEO, and that's those three Falcon 9 stacks. And Falcon 9 itself can lift about 25 tons to orbit, give or take a ton or two. It depends on the load and if they lose the booster and that sort of stuff. The first stage will be reusable for New Glenn. So they are planning on capturing the stage. I don't know exactly how. I haven't heard if they're planning on landing it like SpaceX does, or if they're planning on a soft landing like in the ocean to recapture the booster. The first flight right now of New Glenn is targeted for August, and it's just going to add to the arsenal of commercial and governments to be able to get to low Earth orbit or beyond using all of these boosters. It is cutting the access cost to space by 90%. It is incredible what they're able to do here. And we are living right now. If you guys have been wondering why I've been so focused on this over the last few years, we are living in the space resurgence that we thought we were going to have 50 years ago. And it's literally happening today because these rockets are here. Now, there's going to be a bunch of cool things that we're going to be able to do in space because of these rockets: asteroid mining, colony on the moon, maybe a colony on Mars. So this is a boon in humanity to have this sort of access to space.
Just don't let Wise build that telescope or it'll be hacked.
I'm sure at some point in time, James Webb is going to be hacked too.
Well, thanks for updating us on that. And I'm still waiting for you to answer, what does New Glenn have to do with Glenn Close? Because I thought you said that they were related.
I did not say they were related. You said that they were related. If you ask me what they have in common, I'd say they both have very hot performances.
And many Dalmatians.
I don't know if New Glenn is going to have any Dalmatians.
All right, well, moving on to the next news point there. I heard a rumor, SP. I don't know if you heard this rumor as well, but I heard a rumor that Chris Farrell hates Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. That's what I heard.
I heard that he's hating Spider-Man now at all.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't like the main book in the 616 universe, but the Ultimate book is really good, if that counts.
So there you hear it. Confirmation. He hates Spider-Man. He's literally going to rip the Spider-Man off the back of his microphone right now and also punch the life-size Spider-Man that is to his right.
I mean, anything is possible. Anything is possible. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. So spoiler alert for anyone who may not have seen this movie that's been out for over a year at this point in time. But I don't know if you all were aware, there was originally a different ending envisioned for Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Now, that original ending is still in the movie, but now it just comes a little earlier in the flick. So there was an interesting article over on IO9, which is part of Gizmodo, where they were talking about what was changed, or what was updated, rather. And I have to admit, I'm a bit conflicted, and we'll get to that conflict once we talk through everything here. So,
such
when
a
the movie...
Spider-Man hater, man. Why do you gotta be such a hater?
Yeah, I'm just a hater. So what they did realize is, as the movie was nearing completion, they're doing test screenings, and it was that the ending wasn't quite hitting right with audiences. So speaking to Collider, directors Kem Powers, Joaquim Dos Santos, and Justin K. Thompson revealed that a test screening reaction to the original film's ending, which was Miles being captured, then was not exactly stellar, and it forced them to add the ending we saw currently in the movie, which is when Gwen Stacy goes across the Spider-Verse and assembles her team of spider people to come and save Miles, presumably in the third movie. And what were they inspired by? Well, what is in my mind is one of the best sequels of all time, Star Wars: The Empire Strikes Back. That's right. So according to the article, the ending where Spider-Gwen goes out and gathers Peter B. and Mayday and Penny, Spider-Noir, Spider-Ham. She gets the band back together to go save Miles. You're filled with hope and excitement. Oh, they're going to get everyone back together. That wasn't there until about 6 weeks before the film wrapped, according to Thompson. We actually had a screening, and it just ended with Miles on the bag, and everyone was like, boo, because they didn't like it. We went, oh God, what are we going to do? We got to do something. We ran back, and we quickly scrambled and brainstormed and realized, well, how do we fix this? We watched Empire Strikes Back and said, we see how Empire did it. We're going to do similar. We're going to give them hope at the end, because you have that hope at the end that they're going to go and save Han. So
would you say it was a new hope?
No, because that was a previous movie.
Oh, fair enough.
It was a second hope. So I said I was conflicted. Let me get into the conflict here. I think the ending that they put down after they went and added, I think it makes more sense. I think it serves better than just leaving with an ominous cliffhanger where there's no sense of hope. And I can understand where people who saw the movie would be like, wait, what? We're just going to cliffhang and there's no sense of optimism about what's going to happen. Where I'm conflicted, though, is that's a lot of work for animators to do 6 weeks before you wrap production of a movie. And we've talked a lot on here about crunch with video games. But if you go and look, there's a lot of crunch for special effects studios and animation houses and things like that. And the problem there is these guys kind of get screwed in the end because they start working all these extra hours for more work that's tacked on with less time to get it done. And it just burns people out in the industry. So my sense of conflict kind of comes from the fact that, okay, you added a really good ending, but at the same time, you burned out your animators potentially to try and get this added. So I think narratively it makes sense, but at the same time, I'm just going, man, the poor animation house that had to scramble to get this done in 6 weeks. And it's not just this movie, for instance, where that happens. We've heard similar stories about special effects issues for Marvel. That's supposedly why some of the higher ups in Marvel in part were let go from their jobs, was how they handled those relationships with the special effects houses and the fact that they were mismanaged and they were burning people out and the costs weren't matching up. So I don't know. I kind of want to get you guys' insight. Is the correction making the ending better? Is it worth the burnout we got here? Or do you have the same sense of conflict that I do here, which is I really like this, but at the same time, I don't like how it came about.
I will have to go back to A New Hope, literally, where you had really intense editing happening. It wasn't digitally, but I mean, there were some effects that still had to be added. It was that the story that George Lucas shot was not good. And it took extensive editing to bring it around into the story that many of us love, A New Hope. I think it's almost universal that it is really enjoyed by most people. I'd say a good 95, 98%. And the only difference was he didn't have a team of animators that were doing burnout at the last minute. I mean, he was out of money. He was trying to do smaller practical effects to get it done. I think the end product is why he continually fiddled with it, because he was never really happy with it. And he wanted to continually improving it over the years that he had control over it, to the point where he would have been happy with it. So that was A New Hope. You fast forward to this, if it would have been released as it was, in this era of people not caring about the box office as much anymore, and we can get into the expectations of Dune 2 if we want to here in the next few weeks, but you have a situation where you could have critically damaged the brand. So you had to do something. I don't know if it would have been feasible to say, okay, we're going to delay the release because we're working on stuff, but that has bad press to it too. So I am very conflicted because I'm very concerned about how the industry treats its special effects personnel, but at the same time, they didn't have a choice. They had to change it once it got there. Now, could this have been to the point where they just were wrong to begin with and nobody told them that we're wrong until they saw it on screen? Maybe. I think that's a problem in Hollywood too.
I think some things you aren't going to really realize until you get out of your own echo chamber. Mm-hmm. Because you talk yourself up, you've been looking at it for so long, until you get that outsider opinion, which in this case was people who were seeing the test screenings, then you can kind of see, oh, we had our heads up our own butt here and thinking something, because it's just something that you've been staring at for so long that it makes sense and clicks to you. So I get where they're coming from, because in a professional standpoint, I've had projects I've worked on where I was fixated on something, and then as soon as I show it to my coworkers or brief it to them, then they're like, why didn't you do such and such and such and such? And I'm like, oh, hell. And it's just because you get fixated on what you think is that right approach. So I get that. I just think maybe part of the problem is the rigid timeline in which we're having to apply to get these things done. Now, remember, the movie had originally been delayed, I think, to some extent, its release date. At least I thought it did. I thought they delayed the sequel for a little bit. Maybe I'm remembering wrong.
For me, I think that I would try to separate the issues and come at it from the problem with the industry that you mentioned, with the animators and the overworked and stuff. Obviously, that's a problem. But the whole idea of them changing last minute is something that happens. And if it's a live action, they do reshoots. And unfortunately, they do push out the date usually for that. By the time they have to get the certain cast back together, that often happens. So the fact that they changed this based off the screening under a short timeline is not a problem for me. And I say that because I think it's relative to what's happening. And so a short timeline with live action is clearly a different short timeline than with animation. So then that animation aspect has to have the industry fix itself to not be acceptable to, yeah, we're going to get this done under a pressing crunch. And it's the whole crunch thing you mentioned. So I think for me, it just all comes back to the problems within the animation industry. And that's the only thing that sits bad with me.
Is there a possibility to bring in critics when you actually have the story nailed down? Or is there too much of an issue of potential leaks? I mean, even if you had ironclad NDAs before you start filming or animating in this case, they obviously the story just wasn't going to work and people could have told them that at that point in time.
I think the concern of leaks is why you're not going to see stuff like that. Yeah. And I think that some of it they try and alleviate by doing some of these things in committee or having people plan things out. Some of it we've seen executive interference that has arguably been problematic for some of these movies.
Warner Brothers.
Warner Brothers, Marvel to an extent, with the then head of Disney kind of inserting his thoughts on things that need to be done instead of, you know, let Kevin Feige cook. Adding things in. So
yeah, phase four was definitely bad for Marvel. Absolutely. And I'm hoping that phase five pulls up from that, but they've got a lot of corrections that they need to do. Oh. Not to mention that their chief villain, you know, fell flat recently. So whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. That's we could go down that path, but we won't. Yeah. So we'll see what happens with this in the future. I agree that it does seem like maybe they need to look at the whole concept of looking at things maybe a little bit different in the production cycle. I think with spoilers being so possible now, if they're operating off of a general structure that was set up well before spoilers were easy to be passed around the world, maybe there does need to be a change, SB, because like if the core schedule outline is the same thing that was there before the internet of, you know, you do this, you do that, then you bring people in for a screener. That's not modernizing. So I think there is something to what you say.
So I think we might also be seeing some positive trend also, though, is remember, reshoots have been the nature of everything. They'll do everything, then they'll do reshoots, then they'll crunch to get it done. I think one of the things I heard that was most interesting to me, at least, was they had scheduled, what, like 5 days of reshoots for the Agatha Marvel Plus show. They used one day and said, no, we're done. We've got everything we need. We didn't need to do as much correction as we thought, which means maybe their in-house planning, whoever was running that show, kind of planned things out a little bit better. And they just used reshoots to clean up simple stuff they need to clean up versus trying to change plot points and redo things at the very end.
Yeah, you can point to both Daredevil and Deadpool for that recently that they had to change. So, of course, I think Deadpool was hit with the writer strike and the yes. actor strike more than anything else. But Daredevil, they completely scrapped everything and they started brand new. We just did stories, I believe, last time of bringing on some of the original cast again from the Netflix show. So that they were going to not have on the show. I think that would have been a big failure for the fan base there. So I think that is an example of getting feedback from your fan base, learning what was going on and the fan base saying, oh no, don't do this. And then somebody actually listened and said, no, we need to scrap this and we need to go with another story plot. Still don't know how it's going to actually be received on screen. I haven't seen it. I really haven't been paying attention to the filming of it. I just want to see it when it comes out and make my own determination. I don't know what the right answer is here. There's a lot of money involved and money is not cheap anymore. So, I mean, the interest rates have gone up. So it's making a lot of these productions very risky. So I don't know what to do. Although, if you want to minimize the risk of doing these reshoots, of doing something that's going to flop at the box office, you better have a good story to begin with. So whether that's bringing in people to critique it from the fan base or whatever underneath ironclad NDAs, or whether that's just hiring people that make better stories. I'd say that the whole what if situation turned out pretty good, with the exception of the animation issues involved and the creative differences between the showrunner basically and Marvel Studios. The story, though, was allowed to proceed. And I don't think they cared, because it was supposed to be alternative universes anywhere. Anyway, Steven, you said you couldn't get through the first episode of What If and you fell asleep. Have you gone back to see What If at all?
Not season two yet. I will. Okay. I'll come back to it.
I was just wondering how you thought about the season and if it worked for you or not. So I
haven't been there yet.
We can discuss that when it comes out. But I think it, in large part, it worked for a lot of people that watched it.
Well, let us know what your thoughts are on all of this. We would love to know. And hey, if you are somebody that happens to be listening or watching and has been a part of something like animation, we'd love to know what you felt about the environment. Google. Hey, Google shutting down Gmail. Did you hear that rumor?
No, I didn't until you popped it in the show notes. Yeah, say what?
I saw the internet go crazy with this one. I went, oh, okay, here we go again.
Yeah, apparently the rumor was started this past weekend where people were posting on the X and the TikTok claiming that Google was preparing to shut down Gmail. And there was a post that apparently was spread partially by the fact that there was a longstanding X account that supported the rumor that longstanding Google rumor account that supported the rumor. However, Google did come back and they answered this by posting on the Gmail X account saying, quote, Gmail is here to stay, end quote. Now, of course, the whole rumor comes on the idea that, well, Google's not making money on it or whatever and blah, blah, blah. Like, that's the whole idea about the rumor like this. And I don't know if there's any basis to that, because obviously they mine a lot of data from people using Gmail. But
exactly.
I wanted to bring this point up in the context of conversation. Do we think there could be a point where privacy laws becoming stricter, companies being more held to the privacy laws, meaning, for example, Amazon no longer emails a lot of specifics about orders? That's probably partially for them wanting to hoard the data themselves. But other companies are probably reducing what they have in writing because of privacy laws, things like that. Is there a point where privacy laws or similar changes in privacy practices change that Google is unable to mine a profitable amount of data? Do you think that could happen? Or do you think that it's more so they get enough off of that, you couple it with the additional paid services like the people who are data hoarders like me and have to pay just to be able to have their inbox above that free amount, or they do other Google services because, hey, they're already in Gmail and it integrates and everything. Do you think that it's just doesn't seem feasible that there'd be a point that Gmail would pull back the free amount?
Gmail's the way to get people in. That's exactly what it is. You get what, like 10 gigs of email storage free plus whatever's in your Google account that gets associated with that. It's how they get people in, be like, well, you get a Gmail account now, so now you'll start using Google Drive. Now you'll start uploading things here for Google Photos, and you're going to need more storage space. So start buying Google Drive storage. You know, now that you're doing that, you really hate YouTube ads, don't you? Time to get YouTube Premium. Gmail is the easiest way to get people in the door. That's exactly what it is. Has been since they launched the damn thing. Because I remember back in the day when you had to get the invite to get Gmail. Oh, it was a beta thing back in like, what, 2004, 2005. And it was, okay, this is cool, but what was it to do? It was to entrench you in the Google ecosystem. And you go and look at it now. You use that Gmail account for everything. You log in your Android phone with it. It pulls down all your apps, syncs up all your contacts, pulls down your phone out, backups and everything like that. They have made the Gmail address and the Google account indispensable for doing anything in their ecosystem.
I don't think when they first released Gmail that they had in their minds everything that it has become today. But I would agree with Chris that it has become a gateway for not only you paying for everything else in their ecosystem, but for data mining as well. Look, Google is going to, or Alphabet more appropriately, is going to do everything in their power to continue to data mine, because that's really where their profit is. Their profit is not necessarily in selling the services of data storage or access to programs. Their profit is in being able to sell your personal data to advertisers because they really want to target you, and they become really effective at selling stuff to you. You're like, oh, I didn't know I needed this. And this is amazing. I want to buy it. Or I wasn't thinking about it buying it now, but then you see it over and over and you're like, yeah, I want to buy it. That is the key. And they target you because of your interests, because your age, your demographics, your psychographics. They are keen on all this, and they're going to find ways around it. Legal issues aside, I mean, they're going to maintain legality because they don't want to pay fines in the future, but they're going to find ways around everything to mine your data. And the minute that it becomes ironclad, that they're no longer able to mine that data or sell it or whatever, then Alphabet folds as a company. It won't happen immediately, but it will happen within a couple of years if that ever happens. I don't think it will, but I think it would really crush their entire ecosystem. So as governments try to prevent industries from amassing all this data, they're not going to hit everything. Like, I laugh about it all the time. Everybody says it's a big win of Europe mandating everybody go to USB-C connections. I laugh at that because I don't think everybody has realized that one USB-C connection is not the same as another USB-C connector. They have the ability to program out everything, your ability to transfer data, your ability to transfer power, your ability to transfer so much power. And once governments figure out that they've been fooled and companies will go, aha, you need to buy this special cord for your iPhones in order to enable fast charging and high rate data and all that. Once Apple figures that out and then introduces it into the ecosystem with whatever new product comes out, then the governments are going to go, oh no, we need to do another law to make sure that a cable can do the minimum amount of stuff. Well, you've just created a new industry then. Now it'll be the cable industry or the wireless industry of the data brokerage between back and forth. It's going to be ongoing. So to get back to the Gmail here, it's the same thing. They're just going to find a way around it. And when they find a way around it, they will find a way to monetize it even more.
Well, I would like to know if you are going to start Stargate Pioneer email, because you want that data, don't you?
No. I, as much as I once wanted to rule the world, I am too lazy and I don't want to put in that much effort.
Fair enough. Well, why don't you go and rule the moon then?
Yeah. Before I start this segment, I want to talk to one of our long-standing listeners here, Suncast. I know you're stuck on the moon, buddy, and I know you miss cow tipping, but you need to stop tipping over lunar landers, all right? I know it's fun, but you need to stop doing it, all right? As much as I said before that we are in this new age of space exploration because of our access to space, one of the things that NASA and other countries are doing now is they're putting landers on the moon again, you know, 50 years after the moon landings occurred from the Apollo. One of the lunar landers, just in the past couple of weeks here, the Intuitive Machines Nova C Odysseus, launched on the 15th of February on a Falcon 9. And it was the first American lunar lander since Apollo 17. And it was America's first commercial lunar lander. It landed at 6:23 p.m. Thursday, the 22nd of February. That was right during the sweet spot, by the way, of most United States main news programs. So like NBC, ABC, CBS. So I don't think it was coincidence that the timing for the lunar landing happened around the time that everybody was live and reporting right outside NASA. This landed on its side in crater Malpert A. It was a, it's going to be cut short because a lot of the antennas are in the dirt. So the data transfer is not going great back and forth. It's reduced capability and it will stop working tomorrow as we record this, which is will be the 27th of February. They're just going to shut it down and that will be it. But it was a success. It got the closest to the lunar South Pole than anybody has to date. They use new technology to land it, which will probably be used in the Artemis program as well. And I think from those aspects, it was a success. It did not bomb the moon as other probes that we have covered in the past did. And it didn't fail. It got all the way there. So I'm going to talk about a few others, but do you guys have anything to say about the Intuitive Machines?
Only thing I got to say is leading into your next points. And it's like, you want a lesson in PR spin from a certain space sector, from a certain country, do the math. This is the thing to pay attention to, because this, the way this has been talked about compared to everything else you're about to talk about, man, the spin is real on this. And kudos to that space sector from that country for managing to spin it. Congratulations.
So the next lander we're going to talk about is Japan's JAXA Slim mission. It quote unquote landed on January 19, 2024. I say landed because it also ended up on not only on its side, but nose down. It took 3 months to get to the moon. It took another month once it was in lunar orbit to get down close enough to attempt a landing. And it was down in Sholi Crater. It lost an engine. Literally dropped off the spacecraft right before landing.
Whoops.
Someone didn't use the good duct tape.
I guess not.
Got to use the gorilla duct tape next time.
But what was really cool is it ejected a couple of tiny rovers out the side before it landed. So it actually proceeded to do the whole process up to the point of actual landing pretty well, including losing the engine. So one of its tiny rovers, nicknamed Sora Q, actually was able to take a picture of this thing and confirm that it was upside down. And unfortunately, it just is not designed for lunar night. At the South Pole, it goes through a couple of weeks of lunar night. And most of the lunar landers that are scheduled for that weren't meant to last longer than lunar night. So you're not going to see like an InSight helicopter lasting months and months and flights and dozens of flights longer than it was designed to do. These things are going to freeze and there's going to be no way to bring them back. So once it was determined that it was upside down and they weren't able to get anything from it, they shut it down. And that was the end of Japan's mission. Astrobotics is another NASA lunar lander that is part of their contractual. I'll get to the contractual program that is going on right now. It launched on January 8th from United States on a Vulcan Centaur. It was the first launch of a Vulcan Centaur, which performed great. Unfortunately, once it got up to space, it had a faulty valve, which allowed a critical amount of fuel that would be used for a landing to leak out. So instead of injecting itself into lunar orbit, they decided to not make it into space junk out there and just to bring it back. Even though they were able to regain functionality of the spacecraft, they simply didn't have enough fuel on board to do anything. So it was commanded to return to Earth and it burned up in the atmosphere on January 18th. India sent one up last year, and we didn't really talk about this on the show, but it launched its Vikram, which is the lander part of their mission, on the 14th of July, 2023. It inserted into lunar orbit on the 5th of August, 2023. It landed on August 23rd, 2023, and then it was put to sleep on 3 September, 2023. They were hoping it would survive lunar night. It did not. On the 22nd of September, it missed its wake-up call. So it was declared end of mission. And this was the third attempt at a mission to the moon from India. Vikram 2 lander crashed on September 6, 2019, so pre-pandemic. And the first mission to the moon from India had a, not a probe, but an impact probe or an impact lander, which struck on the 14th of November, 2008. So it's been about 15, 20 years for India to get to the point where they had a success on landing on the moon. Now, all of the NASA programs, so we've had three of them so far, the NASA program, or two of them so far, the NASA programs are with the CLPS, Commercial Lunar Payload Service. Currently, there's eight on contract. Astrobotics is one. Intuitive Machines is another. There's three more that are projected in 2024. There's a few more. I think one more in 2025, a few more in 2026. So we're going to see more lunar landers before Artemis 3 gets to the moon here in the next couple of years. So this will be an ongoing thing of these smaller commercial landers landing on the moon.
Well, I just got to say, obviously, there's really two reasons behind all of these failing, considering the history of us allegedly putting somebody on the moon. Number one, it was faked, which I think we can all agree is BS.
It was not fake. It was not real.
It was not fake.
That is why Suncast is up there tipping over lunar landers. Exactly. And you need to stop that, Suncast.
And the Mythbusters proved it.
So it was real. So we can all agree on that, which takes me to point number two, is clearly there are aliens and or Borg that are stopping all of our new moon missions from being successful because all of them have failed since the Borg have taken over and started their moon base on the backside of the moon.
Dark side.
Yeah. Sure. But the Borg aren't here yet based off of Star Trek canon.
Somebody didn't carry a one. I think they forgot that.
It's reasonable considering that's what leads to bombing other planets. Yeah. Okay.
No, I'd like to have some success here. I'm getting tired of these moon failures. I'm looking forward to my colony on Mars. You promised me, or on Mars, which we have to get to the moon first. And you promised me that was going to happen, SB. So I'm holding you to that. So get these first step going of these moon landers, so eventually I can get to Mars, please.
In order for, you're going to hate this, Stephen. In order for you to get to Mars, you have to root for Elon Musk to succeed.
I'll allow it for that.
Okay.
Well, thanks for recapping all these. And I hope you come to us with some successful lunar news at some point here, SP. I'm getting exhausted.
Well, at least they're not hitting your house yet.
Well, that's the key word.
Yet. All right. Well, that's going to take us to the end of another episode of the Gonna Geek Show. If you didn't know this, we're part of the Gonna Geek Network. There's awesome geeky podcasts over on the Gonna Geek Network. Check that out at GonnaGeek.com, including Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is a podcast that SP does about the Marvel Universe, Cinematic Universe. No, you don't call it that anymore. You call it the Marvel Extended Universe, right? Isn't that what you call it?
It's just that, yeah, the Marvel Universe, basically on-screen Marvel Universe.
So he does that with some awesome people over there. And if you want to check out things that are all things good and nerdy, hey, there's a podcast called that you can check out, Chris, with some other awesome co-hosts over there on ATGN.
It's the Bearded White Man Show.
Indeed. And I got to say, Chris, the rest of us are just struggling to keep up with you, because you got 552 episodes out there right now. I just broached the 500 mark. So I'm 52. I'm a full year of episodes behind you on Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D. Dude, that's amazing.
That's a sustained effort. I mean, it's really weird, though, realizing the only person left from the original cast on the show.
Okay, so can we create a bunch of micro or nano episodes of this so we can pass ATGN? Can we make that happen where, like, to hear a whole episode, you have to download, like, 100 words at a time?
You can do whatever you want with this. This is your show that you produce. We're just, you know, riding on your coattails here. So if you want to make a one-minute Gonna Geek podcast. Yeah, I would say make it a 2-minute podcast. Otherwise, the IAB stats are going to be wonky for
Steven,
you.
You just need to train AI models, an SP model, a Chris model, a Steven model, and then just feed in some news stories and have the AI generated GunnaGeek.com show.
Oh, man.
Fun
that
podcast.
That is so almost possible. If you check out the testing I did over on our Discord with go to the Better Podcasting channel a few weeks ago, I posted a AI model and it wasn't even any effort put into feeding it in. And it wasn't even the good one. And it's frightening.
It's coming real quick.
So for episode 409 of the Gunna Geek Show, I'm Steven saying happy 500th to Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D. and a belated happy 500th to ATGN.
It was only a year late, but thank you very much, Steven. And congrats to Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D. on 500.
Thank you, and thanks to all the co-hosts on both shows. We appreciate you, and we appreciate everything that you bring to the network. Thank you.
Bye!
Thanks for checking out another episode of the official GunnaGeek.com show. If you like the show, please give us a 5-star review in Apple Podcasts or a thumbs up on YouTube. You can always join us for our live recording sessions at www.geeks.live. And remember, you can find our full back catalog at gunnageek.com/show. If you're itching for more geeky content, check out other shows on gunnageeknetwork.com. Voice work was by Emily Prokop of the Story Behind podcast. That's it for this episode. We hope to see you back again next show.